League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast. I'm Ollie Lum, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Seddon. This week, we spoke to the head of athletics at Cardiff Met University, James Thee. James is a World, European and Commonwealth Games finalist in the 1500 metres, who since moving into coaching has helped numerous athletes to their own international success.
Welcome back, guys. Look, we speak to James this week about his role as a team manager at European Indoors. We talk to him about developing, you know, that youth talent from university age into really successful seniors. He's got a hugely successful group at Cardiff as well, numerous sub-four milers and GB athletes. We also talk about his own career and how that shaped him into the coach he is today, a very successful runner in his time as well, 3:37 1500 metre man, fourth place at the World Indoors. So we talk about how that's influenced, you know, the way he coaches today and how he continues to keep learning year on year on year with the athletes that he's currently working with.
Anyway, James, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on. You've just come back from a little trip trip into Europe, haven't you? Why don't you tell us about that to start, if you don't mind?
Well, I'm stuck in my house for a few days because of it. So, I was out as part of the team staff for the European Indoor Championships. So, first time in a year at an airport, first time, obviously, on a plane, in a hotel. So it was fantastic to be there. An amazing championships that I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit more detail about some of the performances. But yeah, on return, it's been documented. Not me. I'm COVID-free at the moment, I believe. But a member of staff has tested positive, which means we're totally at home for the next 10 days.
Sure. Yeah. Well, why don't we crack on with a champ to start with then? Because it was pretty impressive stuff. And what was it like being there? Because I guess that's probably one of the main differences now is that the atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, so you kind of think what it's going to be like. And I think a lot of things we're thinking about, what's the world going to be like, you know, when we get back. And so this was the first kind of, you know, bit of normality. And there was normality when there was a day before the championship start, like a pre-warm-up kind of, get together at the track, and everyone, all the athletes were there, coaches were there. And it was almost like, other than face masks, that this is kind of, well, we're back to normal here. Champ starts, and, you know, I've been fortunate to be, you know, having been to two World Indoors, two European Indoor Champs, and that indoor atmosphere with the crowd, especially a local crowd, normally, you know, really builds it for a champs. And obviously that wasn't there. But you know what? The performances on the track, whether it and the field as well, you know, whatever event it was, because athletes are so hungry for a comp, and, you know, because they, you know, I think it was 500 plus days since the last athletics championships across the board, you know, across the world. And so it was, you know, we were that hungry for it. So I felt hugely privileged to be obviously on the GB staff, but to be sort of trackside, you know, as a track and field fan, to actually watch it and get the feel of it, watching people in the warm-up area and just soaking it all in. But yeah, we're still missing, you know, fans in the atmosphere. There were some great Polish performances. That said, that men's 800. Yeah. Imagine the crowd when Jamie Webb's almost spoiling the party. But, you know, and even the men's 15, you know, again, you know, great Polish contingent, but, you know, just not having that extra element of a crowd. There was some tinny noise that they play in the background and a little bit of music. But yeah, that atmosphere, that cauldron that you get. I did Madrid in 2005, and every single Spanish athlete, it was like a football atmosphere terms of, oh, they were throwing seat covers on the track when their 4x4 team got disqualified. And it was bonkers, absolutely bonkers. But yeah, so I feel people missed out on that. But you know what? Some people hate that and they get put off by it. So I think in terms of comp-wise, I think it was Jamie Webb was telling me that, again, you can hear footsteps and the noise of your own running, where obviously in the crowd and the noise of a track, you can't hear that. So yeah, it's fascinating, the athlete's kind of perspective of them. But once they're there, they're just so in the zone, it doesn't matter really.
Well, I was going to ask, yeah, do you think it did affect any athletes? Like, do you think maybe for the people who like his first competition as well, do you think they rocked up and were like, oh, is this it? Because I know a few comments from the trials race as well. We were speaking to Jack Rode a week before, and he was just saying how, like, it was really weird running with no atmosphere.
Yeah, do you know what it reminded me of? It was a bit like a Bucks indoors because obviously the teams were there. So you had teams and so we were shouting and there was an atmosphere there, but it was, you know, as in, you know, a few, you know, maybe 1,000 people, maybe less than that were actually probably trackside, I would have thought. So I tell you what, some of the events that I started thinking about in a bit more detail that you wonder whether, you know, they're quite sort of interactive with the crowds. Jumps where
jumps and
crowds are clapping, long jump, triple jump, and also in events like the high jump and pole vault, where it's quite sort of showmanship in terms of the camaraderie and the atmosphere. And the, but again, when you look at the performances, the men's high jump was one of the best performances of the championships. So again, you know, I wonder how much it is impacting. I think you could almost look at it and say the great performances that we had would maybe be just even slightly better. Maybe the guy would have gone over 240 in the high jump, you know, and maybe there'd been another couple of other special performances. Yeah, but as I said, also some athletes get put off by crowds and atmospheres. So, yeah, so maybe it played into the fact that people are just concentrating on racing as opposed to the fear of, you know, the noise of the crowd. So, but it's definitely generated a lot of online and you know, new viewers. The BBC had over 1 million people watching. So that's good for the sport.
Yeah, 100%. Massively. What did you, I guess, have you seen the BBC coverage?
No, not yet.
Did you see, like, there was
some of the comments.
Yeah, some mixed opinions, man. I just feel like we have a great sport. It just needs to be televised a little bit better. Me and Lum were talking the other day, and we were just saying, if they just showed, like, the full 3,000 metres, and then afterwards they just showed, like, the long jump, because most of the people, if you're interested in long jump, you want to watch the whole thing. If you're interested in the 3K, you want to watch the whole thing, and it's just... Like, we've been speaking to a couple, like, people, like, in my household, like, they're not hugely into running. Well, my sister's boyfriend's not. And he was just confused with what's going on. And that's, like, the main thing about the coverage. People are just, like, if you're, like, a member of the public, you're just confused. It's hard to follow.
There's a few options there. I mean, I've seen it on a few US events where they've got split screens.
That's what we should have. It's 2021.
Yeah, exactly. It's nothing worse, is it? You know, that you're watching something and you miss the important break in the middle of a race. Yeah. So I think some people think it's the start, you know, where you watch it and then obviously it's the last kilometer. But actually, that's not where the racing really takes place. Yeah. And even with the jumping as well, it's not the last round. Nothing really drastically changes. Maybe sometimes in a really dramatic comp, but it's some of those middle jumps that are so important. I just think having that option of seeing it often, and I you know, this is not to back the BBC up, but they are kind of, it's the broadcast, the local broadcast that choose the images. And so that's why you suddenly get a random jumper that, or often it's a local athlete that you suddenly get, and they're on the screen. There's something worse than watching them prep for 30 seconds, knock the bar off, and you see their reaction for another 30 seconds. So, yeah.
They love the Polish guys doing handstands and stuff. Like,
But split screens and but you know, I know some of the comments are about going to the studio and having chats and you know, for example, in I think someone posted, it might have been you, Matt, but in a football match, there's no way you'd go to the studio after 25 minutes during the match to talk for the next 10 minutes about the first half or about the previous game if it was during the game. So you know, Put another show on. If athletics is that popular, which I think it is, then put a after show that has some highlights and some discussion and get that out to the masses even more that don't want to watch a whole 3K, want to watch a snapshot, want to hear the experts critiquing it and talking about it. So why don't we do even more shows for athletics as opposed to trying to combine it and package it in? Live action sport is live action sport. Let's not cut away and talk about you know, another performance. Talk about, they go back to previous Olympic Games and stuff like that. It's like, no, come on, live sport is live sport.
Yeah, that's the nail on the head.
That's it. And you mentioned the experts, and I think no one's got a problem with like a lot of the things they have to say. But when you're trying to watch something, it then takes away from what they have to say because I'm thinking, where's the 3K, rather than actually trying to listen to what anyone has to say. So yeah, I guess some good points. If anyone's listening, they can take them on board.
We need some guy to go into a broadcasting degree and then come through into the BBC, infiltrate with that athletic knowledge.
I'll take over the whole of BBC Athletics, mate. Yeah.
There we go. James, you mentioned kind of a couple of your own champs as an athlete then. Myself and Matt, when we were prepping for this, we kind of see you as you always a bit of a racer. Would you say that's true? And would you say that you still kind of value placings more than times? Is this still the coach?
Yeah, I think that I was probably an over racer when I was in my athletics prime at some point, but I you know, looked at it in terms of I was lucky to have access to an indoor facility for training and kind of went down the route of having those kind of two seasons where it was, you know, racing indoors. And once January kicked off, you almost raced every week until the end of the indoor season. And then outdoors, you know, kind of again did the same. And so in terms of, you know, maximizing, you know, full potential in terms of the times I ran, I probably didn't do that. But what I did learn, I learned the craft of racing in terms, and I think that's something that kind of gets a bit missed in between. I think that, yeah, again, there's been discussions about people having very good abilities to time trial. Obviously, in the current climate and current racing, that's what people have had. Whereas I was lucky to grow up doing things like the British Athletics League and learning, you know, doing a few doubles in, you know, racing and learning tactics and you know, what you're going to need in the heats of a junior champs in it. And then definitely when you get to a senior championships that you kind of, you know, I think, you know, World Indoors in 2004, around 3:40 to qualify. And then the next day we went through in 2:16 through 800 meters in the final. Yeah. So you need that range. Otherwise you're just going to be very good when it's fast, or you're going to be super good when it's slow, but you're not going to have the tools in between.
Mm. I think Matt and I, like, especially this year, we've kind of been having a lot of discussions about, is the sport potentially becoming too time orientated? And especially now coming off COVID, people have missed races. Are they going to want to go to British Athletics League when there's going to be BMCs, open meets, fast races, pretty much every available slot? Are we going to lose some of that kind of the real racing, particularly on the domestic scene?
I remember listening to you guys on one of the podcasts about things like giving value to the Southerns and championships is like that, where they should be not just a stepping stone, but they should equal something that qualifies you for a national championships, which therefore it wouldn't. It's almost like, and I think, you know, it's going down that route of, yes, obviously, if you've got a fast time, that does gain you entry. But then there also should be the recognition of being able to race and being able to perform. So, again, could be, you know, top three at the Welsh Champs or top five at the Welsh Champs, top five at the Midlands or Southerns, that you get an automatic, doesn't matter what time you've ran, you get an automatic buy to the British Champs. And therefore it might start people promoting the fact of actually that, you know, I don't need to just time trial, that I can go and race. But hopefully it actually gets people doing both. So you do people that have the fast times, but go and sport the champs. But I do think we're in a bit of a culture, and obviously everything. And I think this has been probably a number of years now. Para 10 is fantastic as a resource. But also we found probably a culture over the last few years where people are scared to race because it goes on Para 10. Yeah. People don't want to, you know, take part in certain events because it's, you know, they might get a slower time. But yeah, I think, yeah, having the old, you know, club system of, you know, doing things like British League and earning that, and they complimented then that, you know, the races you went to and ran fast as well. So I think that, yeah, again, that kind of enjoyment. And also it's a different pressure when I used to love going and doing British League. I did a British League 2 years ago. So I did I was on commentary on in Bedford, and then I said, right, I'm having an hour off, went and did the 1500, and then came back. And I tell you what, it was one of the best races, or it wasn't my best race of the season, but it's one of my most funnest, because it was a race. It wasn't about splits and times. It was just, you know, you're wearing your club vest and trying to score some points. And back in the day, I probably would have been chucked in the 4x4 as well, but nowhere near quick enough anymore.
Yeah, I think it's like places, like, for example, British Champs, for example. You could have someone who's finished, I don't know, 6th, 7th, 8th for British Champs, and people, they just much rather look at times. You could have someone who's a lot quicker doesn't even make the final British champs, and you just go, oh, okay, they had a bad day, but they're still a better athlete. And it's this whole thing. It seems like the only way we're classing athletes as being good these days is just by running a quick time.
But there's an issue when you look at things like funding that are purely based time-based. And again, you know, it's a time funnel of that. You hit that time, you don't hit that time. It should be in our event groups, you know, especially, you know, 8 and 15, you know, predominantly is about tactics. You only have to look at, you know, how many of the fast athletes at European Championships didn't make it through. You know, and those that had prepped for championship rounds as well, because, you know, having to wake up the next day and go again. You know, you had super fast heats, you had super slow heats, you had one semi-final went through in 23 and changed through 200 meters. And then I think two later goes through in 26 seconds. And then those same athletes that are qualified have to get up the next day and get ready for a final. And also I just think it's nice that we, you know, I think when you look at certain people's profiles, that every time they step on the track, if you're trying to run fast, it's a mentally kind of draining experience as well. And also you don't always mix up the number of events that technically, if you're a good 1500 meter runner, going to do an 800 for your club, that's the kind of thing you should be doing, mixing up. British Athletics League has a 3K now. I used to love doing that, again, as a 1500 meter runner, because it would normally be a bit tactical. You know, and I could normally show my gears in the last few laps. And I did that a number of times. It's a nice, you know, if you did a 1500, you know, BMC midweek, doing a Brit League 3K on the Saturday where it was a bit tempo-ish and then a bit of a burn up was a win-win, because you topped your engine up, but you also got a bit of tactical awareness out of it as well. So yeah, I think it's something that we need to promote. I think I said to a few people, this time where we've kind of stripped back, well, sorry, comp's been stripped back, now's the time maybe to think about what we need, but also the time of years that there's too many clashes at the moment where there's
heaps, man.
Events on, you know, Brit leagues, you know, need to be put into a position where they're supported, and the fast BMCs as well, and those other meets that are coming through that are going to be, you know that are either new or established that complement it as well. But I think you're having too many events on the same weekend doesn't help anybody.
Well, I think we're going to be spoiled this year, mate.
Oh, it'd be like Christmas.
It's going to
be June time.
I mean, you could run a PB every other day if you wanted to this year.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, some people probably try, I'm sure. Right. So you mentioned like the importance of some of these races, and obviously you're coaching now, and we'll get back onto that in a bit, I'm sure. But if we just like stick with you as an athlete, then. Kind of how did you use them, and how did that differ when? Because obviously you coach yourself for a large period of your career, and you also coached by some other people. I guess how did that change between the two, and how did you use those sorts of races as well?
In terms of which races, Ollie?
The like championship style or the league matches, as well as like the BMCs fast times.
Yeah, I think it was just a case of just trying to complement your season. You know, often, you know, early. You know, in the season, doing like, you know, the Brit leagues were great just to sort of get some, you know, rust out the legs. It always takes a few races to, you know, kind of get yourself, you know, kind of fired up. And then it was trying to pick the races, you know, especially as you climb the ladder and you're chasing qualifying times and chasing, you know, sort of personal best. So, you know, it was always trying to find that, you know, that best structure to a season. But ultimately, it was always about the British Championships and then trying to make teams, whether that was indoors, you know, whether that was outdoors. Had a bit more success indoors than I did outdoors. But I think it was having that kind of range of events as well. And also learning from mistakes. There were years where I look back and think, yeah, I probably did, or seasons, where, especially when I was coaching myself, that, you know, I tried to learn from where, you know, it was doing too many races in certain event groups. But problem is, when you get to a level, your invites come in that event group. And, you know, if you're trying to, at one point, like I was, pay the bills, you know, with your running, then, you know, if someone offers you a 1500, they're not offering you anything else. You kind of have to take it. And that took me to races in Jamaica, a couple across the Amazon in Brazil. And they were obviously 1500s because I had to pay the bills. It would have been lovely to have been given a lane in the 800. Or in, you know, a 5K, but that just didn't happen. So it was, you kind of end up sort of almost, you know, becoming a, you know, I did in my way a bit of a journeyman because of that reason. So I was good, but not never great.
Yeah, mate, we saw that this summer a little bit when apparently, obviously, British Champs wasn't quite as supported as what it could have been. I think it was Whiteman who actually came out and said, he said, it's fair enough. You know, there's people out there who are trying to make money off the sport when they're racing Marseille like a day on the same day or a couple of days. And, they were getting paid to do it. They were getting appearance fee. Whereas British Athletics, they don't offer any prize money for winning the national championships. And there's certainly no appearance fee. So in some ways, you can just understand that.
Yeah, it's a tough one. How many jobs would you turn up to, you know, in an adult life in terms of your work?
Yeah.
And you're going to do a couple of days work for free.
Yeah.
I really feel sorry for the marathon guys that are going to be running in a couple of weeks. It's amazing they've got that opportunity. And I think that's, yeah, first and foremost, yeah, we don't come into the sport for money. No one does.
No.
And we all know that. But when you get to a certain level, you basic necessities of paying your bills. And marathon runners, we know, are a bit like boxers, where you probably only get two or three or four at very most prime fights a year. And some of those end up in a knockout where you don't even finish. But so, you know, and that can be even worse sometimes in terms of your body and your recovery. And so to actually go through a big title fight, but you're going to get no money for it. The obviously the first two that cross the line and get the time, they're going to be, you know, obviously floating on the clouds. They're going to have maybe bonuses in their kit contracts. They're going to be going to the biggest event in the planet. That pays for itself. Imagine you finish third, you know, in the men's race, and obviously Callum's been pre-selected, and you know, and you run 2:10. So you run inside the qualifying time, and you're not going to the games. And for that big effort, you get a pat on the back, and it's like that's quite hard for our sport. Whereas in the US, you finish third in their Olympic trials, don't make the team. You finish fourth because you do make the team if you finish third in theirs. You get probably, I think it was something like in the region of $25,000-$30,000, I think, in terms of prize money plus performance money. So even $5,000. Say you ran the time, the Olympic qualifying time, it would have been great if there was a bit of prize money that you get rewarded for your performance. Don't give it away for anything, but fantastic job. There's a bit of cash.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we're starting to see good ways of people inventing cash, though. You've seen, I think Belgrave announced as well, that Sound running the same, the prize funding, you know, people donating.
Yeah, they did that in the US, didn't they, recently?
Yeah,
just people donated in. Yeah,
I think they actually made, I think Mark Scott got $1,500 for it. So
it helps, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it just, you know, again, you're not doing it for a lot, but it might pay. You know, might pay, you know, when we can go away, it might pay an altitude trip.
Also, like you were saying, it justifies your work that you've put in, you know, so at least you can say to your parents, like, oh, yeah, this is why I'm still living at home and I'm 27 or whatever, you know, I mean, you can just justify it to yourself a little bit as well. And you're like, okay, yeah, you know, people out there recognize my performance.
So that's sometimes I had to try and explain that to people that, you know, would often from the outlet, you know, or outside say, oh, you know, you need to pick and choose your races better. And it was kind of like, you know, the best example I give to people is in 2004, I raced in Madison Square Garden on the Friday night in the Wanamaker Mile. And I made as much money in that race. I finished second and I got enough money to pay the next 6 months of my rent and bills. But the drawback was I had to fly back. I literally caught a 1 o'clock flight back. That's right, 11 o'clock flight back that evening to get back to racing the British Championships the next day. And basically travelled all the way through the night, 16 hours, flew into London, got a plane then from London to Manchester. My wife picked me up at Manchester. We drove across to Sheffield and I got to Sheffield an hour before the heats. And they subsequently cancelled the heats. And I felt brilliant. Come back the next day for the final. And they said, no, the final's in 45 minutes. So I finished second and qualified for the World Indoor Champs. But the irony was, obviously, for that run, I got nothing financially for the second one. But doing the race the night before, paid the bills, and the race the next day got me in the team. So, but I could have just done the one on the Saturday. That would have been great, got me into a World Championship team. But I wouldn't have been able to pay the bills for the next 6 months unless I went and found some other races. So that was the reality of it. And obviously that, in terms of lifestyle and performance, yeah, I mean, I traveled back from Poland the other day. I couldn't even run the next day. I was so tired. So I'm not even sure how I did it. I think, yeah, it's amazing what you can do when you're young.
Yeah. James, were you coaching yourself at that point?
No coach would have let me do
that.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. Like, how much influence do you think that would have had then? Like, I get, you kind of touched upon it earlier, but like, if you were being coached for like a longer period of your career by someone else, do you think that would have played a bigger role in kind of how you chose the races?
Yeah, I think, yeah. No, I don't think any coach would have looked at that and thought that was a good idea. Looking back, there was some, you know, obviously being in New York, I think, you know, racing in what is the middle of the night UK time when my competitors were lying in bed fast asleep. You know, I'm running around Madison Square Garden. But the other thing was, if I'd have won the race, I'd have been drugs tested and missed the flight anyway and wouldn't have made the world team. It didn't really occur to me that I might win it. So I'm quite lucky that I did finish second. And it's just, but, you know, I think, you know, when I look back and I'm quite lucky to have had probably a number of different kind of fun trips like that that I orchestrated myself. Obviously, you know, the athletes I look after now, you know, some of them do some different things and kind of, you know, some slightly wacky ideas. And I'm a lot more obviously open to it, but there is that coaching voice that, you know, again, that, you know, if you, you know, I finished fourth in that World Indoor Championships that year, you know, maybe if I'd have had a slightly different prep, maybe I'd have had a medal. Long-term, that might have been obviously better financially. But yeah, at that time where you are on that breadline, and that's the tough reality. But yeah, I think, yeah, I wouldn't change anything in terms of that I did now. But obviously, I think that's part of why I've gone into coaching, is to kind of pass on and maybe just be a voice of reason. Or but again, if one of my athletes said, I want to do that, I'd probably say, okay, let's, I know how to recover from it. So, and if it works, it works. I mean, I was in the back on the Sunday. That's the funny thing. On the Sunday, I was on the back page of the Sunday, Sunday Times, for 2 second place finishes that neither of the winners had anywhere near the exposure. I was on primetime US TV. They got after. And so these are the fun things when I look back and think, do you know what? I could have lived a lot more of a closed, you know, existence as a runner, maybe have run a couple of seconds faster. But I certainly wouldn't have had a better story to tell. And I've got so many friends now across the world I met doing some of these wacky races and wacky trips that, yeah, I think it served its purpose. But yeah, I think if you were looking at it from a purely performance element, yeah, you'd say, yeah, it's definitely not the best thing.
Mm-hmm. D-list, why were you self-coach, mate? And how long were you self-coached for? Because you did, didn't Mark Rowland coach you for a little bit?
Yeah, I was coached by a guy called Tom Watson when I was a junior. And when I came to Cardiff and met, I kind of, you know, started to, you know, experiment with the types of training. How many weeks could I run 85 miles for? And you know, had good experiences and bad experiences. And then I trained with a guy called Christian Stevenson, who we literally just trained day in, day out, twice a day, every day. And he went to the Olympic Games in 2000 over the steeplechase. So I had a bit of a mentorship through that. In that time, then I kind of sourced out and thought, you know, who is the best coach? This was in the year 2000, so many years ago. Who's the best coach in the UK right now? And Mark, you know, Rowland came to mind in terms of my research. Was known in coaching circles, but, you know, not, you know, to the standard he is now. So I kind of feel that, you know, that I sourced out a heck of a good coach, and he took me on board for 18 months. But he's a coach that is down the line and amazing, but he needs to see you day in, day out. And I wasn't able to move. I didn't make the plunge because I was obviously my roots and base were in Cardiff. And Mark is at work with you, you know, face to face. So it kind of just, you know, didn't quite work. But I kind of felt in that 18 months, I learned so much about that. I think the best thing with going to Mark was it taught me that there's no magic wand. I think often people think about coaches and they think about or schedules or locations and think, you're going to go somewhere and suddenly become better or suddenly make this magic jump to another level. What it taught me was what Mark is great at is doing the small detail over and over, and the hard work is hard work, and it's hard work. And it really taught me that the grass isn't greener, and actually you just got to put the hard graft in. And so when I came out for Mark, I looked around in my locality, and there was no one that could compare to Mark. And even in the UK, really, in my own head. So I thought, well, do you know what? I've had a good kind of exposure to what I think I need to do. I've obviously read and got hopefully a good understanding about what works or what doesn't work for me. So I'm going to take it and see what ends up happening, and kind of the next few years after that probably really helped from having that you know, base work and stuff I'd done with Mark as well, the fundamentals. So it kind of happened from that. So you know, I kind of developed that you know from my own intuition and to said speaking to everyone, but. Yeah, there was no one, and there wasn't the environment back then, which I've probably been guilty of trying to create myself in, with my own group, that there wasn't that group mentality. There wasn't those people around in a kind of large pack, you know, that we see, you know, many of the US groups. So it just wasn't there in my location. So it was either do it yourself or pack up your bags and probably go overseas. And I didn't want to do that either.
So you did a lot of training on your own as well.
Yeah, I look back at some of my training diaries, and I think back to, you know, some of my best years, and crikey, some of the sessions I was doing kind of scare me for their intensity, as in, like, you know, turn up to a track, warming up on your own, doing the whole session to time on your own and hitting the splits. I had one of those old Timex watches that I'd set the beeps, that you could have it beeping. I'd have it beeping every 100 meters. So that was the only kind of feedback I was getting of where this beep was. So lucky with the indoor track, you know, because it was a great environment in terms of there were obviously always people around, and I had various people jumping in sometimes. You know, Jimmy Watkins was coming around that time as well. You'll have to get on with a podcast at some point. But, you know, there were different people that would do different things at certain times, and I'd run with some people. But a majority of a couple of years was, you know, just me, which was good because it kept the focus on me. But I look back now and crikey, some of the sessions, if I was in a group, would have been so much better. And also there were times where if I had a coach, I look back at my training diary and I would have pulled myself out of probably at least 20% of my sessions because either they were too good or they were rubbish and I was getting slower. In my head, I had to finish them because I'd written them. And it's almost like if I didn't finish them, that I might get into a routine, a bit like dropping out of races where you don't want to become someone that drops out of races, because if you drop out of one race, you can drop out of the next. And then it becomes something that you automatically expect to drop out of a race. So yeah, whereas obviously you've got a coach saying you're done, go home, you know, right, let's mix this up now. Let's do threes. Go and do a tempo. I didn't have that. But again, I think in terms of what I do now, in terms of coaching, I think it was me learning how to coach whilst coaching myself.
Mm. Yeah. Did you plan your schedules out when you were coaching yourself? Did you just go, right, you know, sit down one afternoon and you'd have like 12 week blocks done and then you would just stick to that or work? Because now you're pretty flexible. Well, from what I remember as well, you know, that was always a good thing about you. If the weather's honking and it, like today it's blowing a gale, you wouldn't recommend someone go do 400s on the track, for example.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the problem, and it was something that I would plan out, and I thought that I almost had this kind of golden kind of prep for something. And I think that's something you get caught up into. It worked well the season before, so I try and replicate it. And I try and equate it to playing Mario Kart, where you do the time trial version and you've got the ghost of you. So you basically race the ghost, and you know, when it's going well, you're ahead of it or you're equal with it. What I found when I got towards a bit of a difficult period in my career, that ghost was going away. So say you go and do exactly the same track session, exactly the same time, and you're looking at the watch and you're half a second slower, and then it's a second slower, and you just feel, you know, and then it just becomes hard. And I think that's again, you know, learning from my own experience that you've got to try and be a bit more varied and disguise the work sometimes, because you're never in the same place twice. Even if you think you are, you know, May each year might be the same time of year, but you're a year older. So you're either a year stronger, or sometimes towards the end of your career, you're getting a year slower. And you've got to mix it up. You're never in exactly the same place twice. I think that's where I I tried to be too structured at certain points. I look back at some of the sessions I was going out in miserable weather and trying to knock out sessions that I'd done the year before in Arizona on a beautiful evening. And it just wasn't comparable, but in my head, it almost had to be. And that's the difference between being internal, like you're just caught up in what you're doing, and actually someone externally just being a voice of reason. And I do think that I probably burnt myself out a little bit mentally because of that, either chasing or the effort that it takes to do solo sessions over and over again. I think that there is a payback for that, I think.
Yeah, I think, like you say, you can handle it for, I don't know, say if you're having a track season in between races, you can often handle it for a short period of time, but year on year on year, and you're just comparing yourself to old training diaries, is just, I think, like you say, it just takes a toll.
Yeah, so that's one thing I just try and avoid, as you know, totally replicating as I can see. Now, there's going to be similar things in there because athletes love a bit of routine, and they all, you know, they always feel happy with, I thought it was going to be this session this time of year. But that's almost a nice thing, that it's kind of like they're almost hungry for it. What you just don't want is athletes turn up going, oh, it's this session again. I hate, you know, this is, we do the same session every time, every month. And actually, they, as you know, as we did, if we turned up for that session, it was miserable weather, then we would just adapt it and change it. Just, you know, you're better off getting a positive vibe from a session than you are, you know, dropping out on the third rep or time just being horrendous. So yeah, being smart with it is definitely key.
Yeah, 100%. So when did the athletes come along then? Who was the first athlete?
So who was that?
Is it Dave Bishop?
It was Dave Bishop. Yeah. Good homework, boys. I'm impressed with that. So in 2008, Dave Bishop was a 3:48 Cardiff Met student. And he literally just said to me I can't remember what time of year it was, that he was like, oh, can you help me? Might be February, I think, of that year. And it was basically, he was looking to finalize a scholarship to New Mexico in the US. And it kind of like fitted in terms of, you know, talking about people to train with. And it was more, we trained together in that period. And obviously advising, it was a bit of mentorship. And he ended up running 3:45 that summer and got his scholarship to the US. But it was kind of it gave me a bit of confidence that actually what I do, the kind of principles that were behind my training at that period, actually translated in someone else, and also that ability to, you know, to coach. So coach as in, you know, that, you know, rapport, that communication. I really enjoyed it, and it was a real kind of like, wow, okay, I got the coaching buzz quite quickly. And then and obviously, you know, but it was a very short-lived, obviously Dave got that and then went off to the US. So it was I ended up then going and coaching for the next kind of 18 months the athletes at Cardiff Met that had no coaches. Or no one would take them on. So, and I kind of took them on as a mini kind of project, and we had different athletes and different abilities. And around that time, just about a year and a bit later, I was, you know, chatting to Tom Marshall. And again, he had no plan, no structure, no group. And we arranged to meet up the next day to do a session. And I wasn't even running the session. I was injured at the time. And so he ran the session. He said, I really enjoyed that. It's the first time I've done a session with times. And I want to qualify for Bucks Indoors in a couple of weeks' time. And so I was like, well, he's like, can you help me write a program? So wrote a program. And that was Tom Marshall from that day. And he actually helped bring in, I'm not a great believer in recruiting, as in, I think that I've been lucky that athletes have, you know, either come to the university or wanted to be part of the group. You know, Tom was someone that was very vocal about, oh, it's really good what we're doing. And it was about another year later that I suddenly realized we had this massive group. And it kind of almost happened, you know, it happened almost overnight that there was no kind of, I'm going to start, you know, deliberately start coaching and start a group. It was very kind of organic, like a lot of the coaches that start out. And then we had a number of really good athletes come on board. Jan Thomas very quickly after that, Adam Bitchell soon after, Mike Kallenberg. And it was just lovely at the time that it just, you know, just really fitted with where I was at. I was working for Welsh Athletics as competitions manager. So I'm still running. I qualified for the 2010 Commonwealth Games when, you know, they were all back home watching. So it was great. And it kind of helped me in that last part of my career because I had a group. I was suddenly doing, you know, talk about not having a group. I was doing the 10-400s in the middle of a group. And that was buzzing when I, you know, when I finished my you know, day at work at Welsh Athletics. And the last thing I would have wanted to have done would have been to have gone to the track and done a session. But turned up to a track and there was like a mass group of people buzzing and wanting to do a session. And that was great. For it. So my 2010 Commonwealth Games was down to those guys having people to train with, because there's no way doing 80, 90 hours a week working as an NGB. I put on the Commonwealth Games trials and organized all the kit for the Welsh Athletics team and then ended up going to the games myself. So, yeah, I don't think many kit managers actually get onto the field of play normally.
Wait, do you want to talk about the game? Talk about the games a little bit, mate. Because it was in Delhi, wasn't it? I believe there was some strange experiences there.
Oh, what, in Delhi? Well, my 2006, I got food poisoning in 2006 at the Melbourne Games, and that was gutting when I was in fantastic shape, and that ruined my commie games experience. So getting the opportunity then to go to another championships. A little bit older, a little bit wiser. Different continent, different games. It was a great experience. As I said, like, you know, to obviously have had the role in terms of organizing our own trials and everything like that. But yeah, we had a great team, the likes of Christian Malcolm, Di Green, and obviously Christian's now got the head coach role at British Athletics. So that was a fun trip, Delhi.
I just want to kind of touch upon, like you mentioned, like you kind of coached the guys who didn't really have a coach at Cardiff Met to start with. And what I kind of love so much about your group is that's not the case anymore. Like your group is so big and diverse in that there's always a place for someone. Or like I definitely had that experience, like when I first started, that like it wasn't like, oh, you have to like run a certain time to get into James's group, or you have to be this caliber athlete to get in. Is kind of like, if you're willing to put in some work and just be a good kind of bloke, I guess, or girl, like you can train with the group. Whereas I know some universities are a bit more, there's a bit of a pecking order into who gets into what training groups.
Yeah. What's the dynamics now, James? Cause I know you said you had a big group then, but it's massive now, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that what I've tried to do at Cardiff Met is have something that's quite diverse. Having someone like Piers Copeland come to Cardiff Met, not come to be coached by myself. These are really good stories to have, because you know, we have these coaches that look after us. And what we're trying to do is create something that creates an environment for the athletes. Piers jumps in with some sessions with ours, runs with the guys all day long. But he's got his great coach, Bob Smith, who writes his program. And it's fantastic to see that. And we've had athletes that, you know, have done that over the time, that have dipped in and out. And I think that having a group that you can be part of, but you don't have to, you know, it's not, as you said, you know, there's no time base that you have to achieve to get into. And there's this, you know, this open door policy, whether you, Dave Bishop went to New Mexico and then came back in the summers, was joining in for sessions. Charlotte Arter, who obviously came to us, and improved massively, then went to New Mexico and then came back to the group for a while before then going to be coached by Chris Jones. And we just had so many people over the years that I'd like to think that, you know, if people, you know, have obviously been at Cardiff Met, that they can be part of the group. If they end up staying in Cardiff and they end up, you know, getting a job in the vicinity and want to come for one session a fortnight, one session a month, or every single session we have. And then we have people that travel sometimes across the pond, across the water to be part of the group as well. So I think that there's just, you know, we're lucky in an event group that, you know, does have the capability to open up to the masses. If I was coaching pole vault or a technical event, it would be a lot hard. I think that, you know, we're lucky in certain sessions that we try and orchestrate it where you can run to time. We obviously the luxury of the outdoor track now that's been, you know, a couple of years in the opening, that we can have obviously big numbers out there. And so we try and keep the groups together and obviously mix and match it. Whether you're a fresher coming in and just thinking, oh, I want to try running, or I'm doing a little bit of running, but coming along and getting involved. And whether you're someone that comes in, we've had some GB internationals come in this year Nathan Gillis, for example, that's, you know, come for a year and just jumping in. And again, you know, some people coming back from a US experience where it is about the team, it is about numbers. And they maybe find a bit more of that again when they're part of our setup at Cardiff Met. But I mean, if you start going on time based, you know, Jake Smith came to us as a 15 and a half minute, 32 and a half minute 10K guy. Now, if you're going to be, you know, if you're a pickety coach and you're not taking someone on board like that, which, you know, there might be coaches out there that wouldn't have taken a Jake Smith on board, yeah. Because they've already got, you know, I've already got 5GB internationals. I don't need a 15:30 5K guy. Well, 3 years later, the kid ran 60:30 for half marathon. So how many of those are getting lost in the system? For our system, maybe it was a reason that it, you know, his first session on the grass at Heath Park, he's in a session with Steve Mitchell, Jake Hayward, Tom Marshall, Yian Thomas, and he's on the back of this group and he is holding on for grim death in a pair of long shorts, a rugby t-shirt, shoes that don't look like they fit him properly. That was his first session. But our group allowed that to do that. Not many sports could you go on to a field in your first session and you're literally, you're there with the pros straight away. And it hopefully gives that capability and you know, gives them a taste of it straight away. Yeah, it doesn't work for everyone, but yeah, I think it kind of works for a lot of people.
Mm.
Do you want to talk about Jake a little bit, like how that sort of it's one of the biggest progressions, like, I mean, I've ever seen, and probably yourself as well, James. Do you want to talk about sort of like managing that in year on year? Because, you know, did you have goals year on year? And, you know, did you even, I want to touch upon like your belief a little bit later as a coach and what you believe in your athletes. Did you even believe like he was capable of that?
Well, that first session, you know, when you see a kid that looks like he's 12 with bowed legs on the back of a group. And these were 5 minute reps on grass. And first one he's there and he's, you know, he's puffing a bit, third, fourth, fifth, you know, he's starting to drop off. But so the mentality of Jake, nicest kid off the track, on the track, is someone that will go to the absolute mill. Now you can't always teach that. And very, very rarely can you teach that. That's inbuilt. So if you were to ask me on that day, is that kid pretty strong mentally, I would say yeah, there's something there. And you know, and when you start doing some digging, you know, obviously he'd done some GB mountain running. He'd actually run 70 minutes for half marathon a week before the Great North. So 70 minutes for an under 20 athlete is actually pretty good. But when you talk to him, he'd never had any structure in his training. It was all a bit hit and miss. He'd had a couple of injuries because of that. And that's often the biggest thing, you know, going back to Tom Marshall, that was the big thing with Tom. There was no structure, there were no goals, and there was no one maybe drumming it in to him to believe in them, or that period in their lives, you know, wasn't there, even though they might have had that previously. And they're really simple ones to coach, is, you know, okay, creating a bit of structure. You know, obviously when you're at uni, the goals are quite simple, aren't they, in terms of, you know, we've got their meets. You know, well, Liverpool's the cross you all want to do well in before Christmas, isn't it? You want to run a PB maybe for 3K at the Christmas Classic because that's kind of nice before you go home. Then you've got, obviously, you know, if they're not goals, but, you know, Gwent League stone in there, but you might have a position goal in there. And then after Christmas, you maybe got your area champs. And then obviously Bucks Cross. And then you might hope for, you know, another opportunity to run indoors before then going into the summer. So it's fairly explanatory when you come in at that age, of, you know, because they've seen who's there before. And so it kind of makes it easy in terms of, right, there are little goals for this year. The structure of the training obviously is around that, you know, periodizing into, you know, cross and then a bit of indoors and then obviously to the outdoor summer season. So he was one of these people that once you gave him structure, and I remember the first time we did some short hills out the back of the indoor track. And he just face couldn't believe we were doing 10-second hill sprints. And it was just like, I've never done this because it's really short, this, you know. And I think a lot of athletes, especially endurance athletes, just think it has to be long reps and it has to be a super hard session. After about three or four of them, he was knackered because it was something totally different. And we got really big benefits and, you know, improving his running economy from, you know, doing some things that he hadn't done before, like, you know, a bit of speed work, whether it was running 10 200s before going and doing a steady run. I'm really working on the kind of mechanics. And that first year was just, you know, real, just getting structure, you know, almost building that running economy. But the big thing we had in the summer was that he by the end of the summer was starting to get tired, running some poor races. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a chat and it was, you know, it was like, I think you need to take a break. And it was, I don't normally take breaks. And it's like, well, look, I think at the end of the summer now, you need to take a week off, maybe, you know, maybe even 10 days. And he had that 10 days or a week off and did the whole classic. There's a race next week, local 5K. Can I do it? And I remember thinking, well, do you know what? Yeah, go and do it. Bit of fun. And he went and ran a 20-second PB. I think he ran like 14:20 something.
Wow.
And it was like, I can't believe I've done this. I had that time off. I thought I was going to lose fitness. And actually the conversation was that you don't lose fitness, you know, sometimes you just freshen up. And actually all that good work, all those hard training sessions, all those hard races where you're starting to buckle in, you've actually absorbed it now. And it was a bit of a light bulb moment that first summer where he suddenly realized that the magnitude and importance of rest and recovery. And from that day onwards, he was religious in taking rest and recovery and the importance of it. And you just saw this kind of wow. linear curve, you know, of performances and of, you know, always people in the group to chase. You know, obviously when it was quicker stuff, you know, he was nowhere near the front. He was chasing, you know, the Jakes and the Toms of this world. And the rest of the group. And he had great housemates, the likes of Piers and James Hennigan. So they're running together day in, day out, the Howarth brothers. And so the real running culture, you know, there that they were just building on. And obviously his best mate, Kieran Lewis, who they're just thick as thieves in terms of mileage and those long Sunday runs. And he's one of the only people that I can give to. He loves a full program sometimes in terms of like seeing a program a few weeks in advance. I've done it a few times where we've, you know, sometimes it'd be like a 10-week half marathon program. Mm. And it'll be obviously a step up from the previous year. And he's the only person, oh, this is brilliant. Love this. Can't wait to do this. And some of the sessions on there are like, you know, really, really hard sessions, you know, eight times K on K off, or, you know, or, you know, 15 times a K sessions that, you know, as a mile, I'm looking at them thinking, I'd hate to be given that, you know, 2 times 4 miles at half marathon pace. It's like, I can't wait to do that. It's going to be brilliant. And that's his attitude. He's such an easy athlete to coach because he's so enthusiastic and so grateful as well. He's always saying thank you. And I don't know. It's just that there's certain people that you really hope that they get the most and they just deserve it. And you just saw with it, you know, how humble he was after the World Half, that many people to run the time he ran and would think that they've made it or they're suddenly, you know, above everyone else. And in fairness, it's probably made him even more humble to everyone around him. So, it's just been fun. And we've got some plans for the summer. If you can run 28 flat at Tonopandy track with your housemates pacing you in a pair of normal spikes, then who knows what could happen this summer.
Yeah, I know. I saw it as a normal spikes, which is even more impressive.
Sad we have to say that nowadays.
But, yeah, you just do though. I was going to say, like, did you expect the 60-minute half? Coming. You'd seen workouts and stuff too. Because I think that's a huge thing with a coach athlete. Like, it's all well and good the athlete believing they can do something, but the coach almost needs to believe it as well. Because an athletes are smart. They know, like, you know, the if the coach believes they can do something or not, and if they trust their coach, coach can believe them.
It's funny. I mean, I haven't always been right, but some of the guys in the group know that I'm quite good at my predictions sometimes. And do you know what? That hopefully is testament that what we're doing training wise equates to something. Because if it was a stab in the dark and you don't have any idea that when he ran his 64 flat half marathon after a year, I remember stood, you know, with Spencer Duval, I think it was England head coach, like, look out, this guy is going to run 64 minutes. And sure enough, Jake comes down the finishing straight and runs 64 flat. The next year in Paris, I literally wrote in my training diary, and it had parameters of what was the max time. And it was 62 flat was what I predicted based off the sessions he'd done. And I took a screenshot on my phone because I remember thinking, no one's going to believe me. So I took a screenshot, saved it, and he ran 62 flat that day. And I sent it, I put it online.
It went out on Twitter, didn't it?
I put it out just as a kind of like, you know, this, so, you know, it was kind of expected. And then going into the big half for selection for the world half, he was getting towards what I thought was 61 minute flat kind of territory. But that was about qualifying for the Worlds that day. And he ran 62 minutes pretty much on his own that day in horrible windy conditions. So I knew that day he was ready for something. And we hadn't even done the final block. There was another 4 weeks of kind of training to prep for the world half. So I knew then that I had it written down that he could break 61 then, but obviously that didn't happen. World half got canceled. When he ran that, you know, obviously that 28 flat and improved his 5K in the summer, I knew the tools were getting even better in terms of, you know, having that those you know skills. If you're going to run sub 61, you've got to be cruising 28:30 at least at halfway. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. If your PB for 10K at a time is 28:30, it's going to be super hard to go out in that pace and then hold it. And so there were some key sessions, you know, where he was, you know, running, you know, two times that 4 miles and running low 18 minutes. For the times. And then the Tuesday before we went to the track and it's a usual pre-race session that is, you know, a couple of miles tempo, then some 800s with float in between and then a couple of miles tempo. And through the whole session, I think he ran something like 9 flat for the first 2 miles. And I just remember how easy he was looking. Every lap, I was like, is that easy? Is that? And he's like, no, I feel good. I feel good. And I was like, just slow down a little bit for me, if that's all right. And he'd come out in the next lap, it'd be the same. And I'd be like, just slow down a little bit. And he's like, okay. And I remember that day thinking halfway through the session, this is one of the best sessions I've ever seen. I've got two choices now. I let it go as it is. And he's going to absolutely fly on the weekend. Or, you know, I pull it now and he absolutely flies at the weekend. Or I pull it now and he thinks that I shouldn't be pulled off the track. It's a great session. So I went with the psychology of it, going back to that first session with the kid that just is fearless, that actually the psychology of it was just let him do it. He's in such good shape. And actually the session, he ran 40 something minutes. I think it's 44 minutes at 61:15 pace on the track. So, and it would look, and it was a fartlek. It was a fartlek and it looked as if he was cruising. And so when he finished that, I went home and wrote some splits down and it was, I think it was 60:35 I'd written down. And on the day he hit almost within the second, I think the 15 kilometers I had to the absolute second. And you know, obviously, you know, he brought it home at the end. So, you know, but yeah, you do as a coach when you watch those last pre-race sessions, and every coach will get it. And it is so good that you have that split second of, is this too good? I don't want to leave this workout here because this would be a tragedy if it happened. But then it's also, you've got to know the athlete and their psychology. And if I'd have pulled him out of the session, he, that might have been mentally a bad thing because he might have thought, oh, was I looking bad? Was I feeling tired? Yeah. I didn't finish that session. So it's the balance you have. So, but yeah, he's very good at putting your eggs in a basket and getting the most out of himself on that one day. Others aren't. They need a few races and want a bit more reassurance. For him, the sessions that he does, I think, gives him that reassurance.
Mm. Yeah, it's really, and you can just see like the excitement of you kind of living it back as well. And I guess that must have been so, like, almost the anticipation for you then. It's like, wow, I've got 10 days to wait and see what you can do.
Was it even before? No, this was the Tuesday before.
Tuesday
before. So that's why it was so even 4 days.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And that's why as a coach, sometimes. Wow.
I thought you meant the,
No, but that's why. And you look back and think, crikey, I mean, it was bold, but that was his pre-race session. And when someone can run 13 miles at 4:34 a mile, whatever it is, 4:35 a mile, that actually, when you look at it as a session, it's really good, but actually you should be able to do that. But then when you haven't done that before, and as I said, it's that fear of, you know, you just don't want to overcook it. That's what you're always on the envelope of overcooking it. The history showed that he, you know, he was coping with the training it was doing at the time and he was buzzing for it. But yeah, on the day, my wife had to go and apologize to the neighbors because I was shouting at the TV like it was, you know, the Champions League football final. And when he was there at halfway, smiling and waving. That's, you know, often you might ask coaches why they coach. And it's those moments where, you know, all the hard work and the months and months of the hard work that the athlete's putting in and you're advising them and helping them and steering them. And then to see it actually come off, and you know, he finished second European, regardless of, you know, obviously the ins and outs of everything else going on, he raced really well. And actually, yeah, and not everyone in the last few years has run as fast as him. Very, very few have got near that at the moment. Plus, we were talking the other day about 60 minutes is the next goal for half marathon. So again, that's really exciting. And we can see over the next year or so, or the next few months, how that is possible. So sub 60 again, that's bonkers stuff.
That's huge. Mental. Mate, that leads us on quite nicely to the coaching side of things. Like, obviously you were super excited and stuff, and I think there's a lot of coaches out there. I want to talk about sort of coaches and the structure they have. A lot of coaches just go completely unrecognized in the UK, and it's just almost like a discussion topic how we can improve that, really, because one, a lot of coaches are voluntary. None of them get paid. Two, a lot of them, go completely unrecognized. Like, for example, Piers Copeland, like, obviously we've seen a lot recently, like after his Euro indoors, Bob Smith, but fairly like low profile. Would you agree with that?
I think it's almost like how we
get coaches to pay, because you're not going to get the people who are passionate about a sport coaching. Because we're almost seeing a transition from the older guys who just go down to coach, they do everything for free. But the younger guys coming in, they need to justify, coaching and spending all these evenings with athletes and stuff.
Yeah, it's a really, really tough one. I mean, I'm super lucky to have a super supportive wife that, there were, a few years where I was almost coaching every single night of the week.
Yeah.
With a young family at the same time, and, not paying the bills because, my job, my role.
For free.
I was getting paid, if I wasn't coaching that evening, it wouldn't have impacted anything other than, that it suited my personality and was my passion and what I enjoyed doing. I think you're dead right. Some coaches out there, I feel a bit bad sometimes that I often get publicity a bit more sometimes than others, just by almost having a profile. But then, hopefully I see it also as a positive that actually having a bit of a profile and raising and coaches, having that discussion. Great to see, I've been loving Mark Cookway's books and reading about the development and understanding and the way. And Mark's always been great with the Tonbridge in terms of getting their story and their message out there with videos, with social media. And I think not all coaches want, not the limelight, but want the publicity. But do you know what? Every coach wants a pat on the back and to be told good job. I'd be surprised if anyone doesn't. When Piers runs well, I literally send Bob an email within a couple of seconds with my Cardiff Met hat on, and he always responds within a couple of seconds. And it's funny, when Jake ran well, he sends me the same email, and it's just that nice thing of great job, coach, well done. For getting it right, because the same with the likes of Steve Vernon, who was brilliant on your podcast as well, and the other coaches, Gunny and the guys that. When they have a good performance, we always ping messages to each other. It's always well done, because you always know that the hardship and the tough bits behind the scenes, even if they're a professional coach, even if it's their job, everyone normally goes above and beyond. How we can raise the profile? I think that maybe down the line it will go to a bit more of a professional element where athletes might start paying sometimes for coaching. I do think that recognition, and I think that our national governing bodies, will have to keep stepping up to bring profiles of coaches through. I've just taken a role with the British Miners Club in terms of development of coaches, and that's part of my role. And there'll be a questionnaire survey coming out very soon. Because again, it's a discussion of what do coaches want, and it's like, well, let's ask them, and let's get coaches involved, and let's find out what coaches are thinking and needing and wanting. And hopefully in that role, I can help promote the coaching, especially in the British Milers Club. We've got some amazing coaches. Some are under the radar, some are on the radar, but we need to get them talking more. And just share that info, share that knowledge. I don't think it's one that, it definitely won't be solved overnight.
No.
I think athletes are always also at a bit of a job sometimes to showcase and maybe just say, often a lot of athletes are. But yeah, just make sure that they're vocal about the great work their coaches do. Because you're right, if you're a young athlete, sort of not a young athlete, but you're an athlete coming towards the end of your career, young in terms of coaching, that justification of why you're going to do it. I know Welsh Athletics have just opened another scheme for Welsh international athletes that want to go into coaching. And we need to maybe just jazz up some of the, you know, the qualification and kind of profile of coaching as well. And as many paid roles as we can get as well, whether it's at universities, whether I wish we had a few more pro teams as well. So there was that tier of kind of job opportunities, because that's ultimately what you want, is if, you know, if there are a few more pro teams. There's been another two this week in the US that have sprung up, and I'm thinking there's all these US pro teams and these coaches that are getting jobs. They're not coaches by definition, as in that some of them are, that's their first gig. Yeah. Is there a head coach at a pro team? So I know that happens in football, which and I suppose that's how they kind of look at it. That, you know, Lampard player, there you go, you're now the Chelsea manager. So whereas in coaching, in our coaching role, it's been a bit more, well, you have to do at least 10, 15 years of hard graft, and you have to do all the stuff first before you get a really big gig. So maybe if we had a few more pro teams, that could be good.
I think a lot of the problem now as well is we almost competing against the this wave of online coaches. Like if you're going to choose to take your expertise somewhere, you could go and chuck something on Instagram, even if you don't have expertise, and get quite a lot of money for it. So it's almost that catch 22 as well, that we're trying to compete with this kind of wave of
influence. Yeah, that was going to be my next point as well. Like, you've got, they're almost like, I don't want to say they're inexperienced, but you've got a lot of people out there who are doing online coaching and charging like quite a lot of money for it. And then you know, you've got coaches who are, you know, very clued up, been in the sport a while, and they're doing it all for free, where it's just finding a way to, like, you know, give some money back to them, in a sense. But sometimes I think, should the coach just, you know, charge the athlete? I mean, most parents understand that if they take their kid to football club, for example, they have to pay, I don't know, £2 or £3 a session. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a tough one, isn't it? We come from a sport that historically has had that culture of it being free, and I think that it would have, the whole sport would have to change its dynamics slightly. Mm. You speak to other sports, or I know as a parent actually, when, you know, I take my kids to certain activities, and you have to pay for it, and it's almost like, well, that's accepted. If I took my kids to a tennis session, for example, you'd have to pay for it. There'd be no. Take them to mini rugby on a Sunday morning, and it's free, and the same with athletics. But, you know, I do think that there's a level maybe of performance, and a level that, you know, athletes sometimes that they would be happy to pay maybe more. But then hopefully then the issue then is the coach then has to be professional in terms of times, and then it becomes a different dynamics of relationship as well. So that's one thing that, I mean, it's a fine balance, isn't it? You know, when you're paying for something, but yeah, there are a lot of online coaches. Some are very good. Some, you know, I think the problem with online coaching is there's no real kind of, policing of it, is there, or kind of quality assurance. And I don't even know if all of them have qualifications. Just sounds like you can just say, I'm a coach, athletes coach, and then chuck your details on. Put a PayPal account and you're away. So, yeah, I think that it's an area that I think that definitely can be explored more. But, it'd be interesting to see over the next few years now, when we reemerge from the pandemic, things change. You know, financially, people's livelihoods might have changed slightly as well. Whether there's a change or a shift in how many volunteer coaches are going to be back at clubs, having not been coaching for a year. Maybe they've enjoyed being at home with their families, and actually their families know who they are now. It's going to be an interesting one. Hopefully we have so many people wanting to join athletics clubs that actually even more coaches are needed. That would be a nice problem.
Yeah.
100%. It's interesting you mentioned like how we come out of this pandemic. So we were actually wanting to talk to you about, how do you think like a nation in terms of athletics comes out of a pandemic successfully? And I guess there's no right answer to this because we don't know yet, but are there certain steps that kind of we need to be thinking about in terms of getting people involved, like young people, and also I guess the current elites, making sure that they've had enough, or it depends when I kind of we class it as out of it, but there are some things to think about, I think.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Ollie. I think one of the big problems we have right now is because we're seeing, same with, you know, Premiership football or elite sport, we're seeing elite sport and someone's thinking, ah, people have done really well through the pandemic. That tier below, if you're a under 23 high jumper who's non-elite, you might not have been on a high jump bed, depending on location, for a year now. Mm. You might have missed your opportunity to go to your last English schools, your last SIAB championships, your last couple of, school comps that or club comps that would have kept you motivated then when you went to university, maybe to keep going in the sport. I think that, we're looking at some age groups that people would have tried athletics in the last year, that would have picked up a javelin, might have, ended up going to a local club and finding out actually they're a pretty good hurdler. So I think we're going to have, and not just athletics, but in all sports where, you only have to think back to our own sporting journeys, probably from the age of 10 to 16, where we tried probably every single sport. Most winters, summers were taken up, whether it was at school, whether it was in clubs, that has literally been on hold. And I think for kind of skill development, social development, physical development, everything that goes into that pot for those, those kids, we're going to be gapped for a while. And that's the biggest worry when we come back is of, where is everyone going to be at in terms of development? Obviously every country in the world is going to be similar. So this isn't going to be, just us. I think then it's a point of schools and clubs and NGBs saying, right, we need to really be on the ball ready. I'm not sure we're going to be because it's so, we don't know when we're back. There's this thing of, we're going to be back in June. Everything's going to be fine in June. Welsh Assembly government just released their update today. You can go and play golf and basketball and travel 5 miles now. There's no mention of anything else. So there's no junior clubs that can open up. There's no, we can't train as a group of 30 like we could do before Christmas. Facilities won't open up at university like they were pre-Christmas. And so you suddenly think that's another 3 weeks. We're then into April. Wow, we all know that April then into the summer goes by so fast. So I think as a nation, we've got a big, big issue right now with people's physical activity levels. They were low before anyway. That's the joke. Mm-hmm. The levels of people not hitting the recommended weekly amounts was super poor. Throw in a pandemic, throw in everything else around it as well. And our sports, are run by volunteers and especially officials in athletics, obviously an aging population. Are they going to be back to officiate? I hope they will. I hope they are. But there's so many unknowns, so many questions. I think we're going to be feeling this for a number of years. I'd love to be proved wrong. Everyone comes back and everyone's even better than they were pre-pandemic. Numbers of clubs are through the roof. I think we've been fairly lucky in our age group, being distance runners, that we go out and run. And we saw that with some of the times at podium and some of the times over. Some of the races over this summer, that age group that ended up, maybe not working, not traveling, and having a bit more time to do a morning run and recover. Yay, brilliant. But I didn't see sprint results go through the roof in the summer with the sprints meets. I would have thought most of the age groups events were really, really struggling. So, there almost needs to be an NGB team put in place that is the pandemic response team. Rather than at the moment, people have their own jobs. They have their own jobs and own roles that they have to do their jobs anyway. Then there almost needs to be a task force put in place that is right. Let's coordinate the home nations. Let's coordinate our response to this. Mm. Let's have a reasonable return to competition. Rather than everyone decide they're going to have a comp on the same day and the same week. Let's actually make sure that we have different events around the country for different event groups. And there's a plan response to it. Rather, it looks like it's going to be a bum fight, free for all. As you said, we can run a PB every week. Yeah. Also, we could all end up injured. I say we. I'm going to be racing on the track as well because just got to love it. But you know, if we all end up racing five times in June, we're all injured in July.
I love what you're saying there, because it seems like, you know, pop-up meets are going to go ahead, but you know, I think there was, we were speaking to someone about the English schools as well this week, and you know, what's going on with that? Like, seems like they might just turn it into a one day event. Seems like the actual big championships, you know, which like, especially youth kids, that would be the highlight of their season. Stuff like that's not going to go, you know, or going to be completely different, or, you know, not going to go ahead, but you're just going to get loads of pop-up races, and that can like lose, you know, lose interest.
Oh, it's so tough. I mean, how are you going to qualify for the English schools?
There's probably not going to be a county school saying that.
I mean, it was tough to qualify for it anyway. It's going to be even tougher to qualify for it. I feel for all these kids that have missed out on, going to events, any level. I mean, obviously, you know, you go to some of the highest level, you know, that those people have missed out on international vests and, you know, at honours and, you know, those English schools, you know, medals or those vests, you know, for the internationals. But that's their reason to keep going in the sport and justify putting the hard work in. And the longer we keep not giving people a justification to train, I found it as a coach, you know, and you guys both know me, I'm super highly motivated, but to keep planning training without actually having, you know, real comps in the date, in the timelines, that's been the hardest thing. And that was the hardest thing probably about 6 weeks ago, when I just got to a point where it's just, this is like Groundhog Day of, you know, you're trying to keep people motivated, you're trying to plan, but you don't quite know where you're planning for. And we're just training based off your races. We adjust your next race, what you've got to do based off those performances. So when you go year, you know, some of the guys would have gone a year without competing, but what has blown me away is people's, you know, mental resolve. I think that, people have stuck to their guns. I would have thought we'd have a number of people that would have just packed it in, and actually the opposite, like, you know, some people have come back out the woodwork that, you know, that have actually found a bit more time to run. But again, that's the running versus the event groups and the age group that it's in as well. So, I think a real national push on the age groups, especially the more specialized events, you know, that's going to need a massive investment and push in the future.
Have you had any athletes yourself who have like just lost interest at all?
Not within the endurance crew. I know with my Cardiff Met director's hat on that, you know, try to stay in contact with athletes and you know, ping messages. But, you know, if you're setting event groups and you haven't been able to get into a track or get into a gym, I can't see if you're a 20, 21 year old, where you're looking at going, well, there might not be any competitions in the summer. I'm not going to be able to get training fit for a competition. That's been the hardest thing, you know, having seen some athletes that, you know, as I said, I know that would have been competing for us in, you know, some of the meets and training and they're not going to have that opportunity. So I probably won't know the full extent of it until we come back. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, especially from a university point of view, those that I said that would have been motivated to stay in the sport because they've had a really good under 20 experience, that they're going to be coming to university next year. Hopefully they come to us and we can actually reignite that. And actually with the resources and people, I'd like to think that that'd be one of our, I take responsibility for that and all the universities should, that would probably be one of our roles to really kind of maybe coax people back into the sport that have been lost to it probably for 18 months prior to it. So I think, we're all the universities can have a, you know, really important role in that. But again, having someone above just kind of direct things and you know, I think that would be hugely beneficial. Whether that happens, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I like that point.
Yeah. With that, has there been any impact on like the recruitment for the unis themselves? Like, I guess it's a bit early maybe for this year, but I guess in September, did you get people who kind of said, we're not going to come because of the pandemic?
Actually, in September, not the opposite, but people that said they were coming came. Yeah. I was always very upfront in terms of, you know, I never promised people the world. And at that point, we couldn't promise anything. I think because people had such a disrupted few months prior to it that actually people wanted to almost get out. The sad thing was we got to some normality. We had, you know, you were there, Ollie. We were talking about the training sessions where we had these bespoke Cardiff Met kind of training sessions. It was like the US system where it was just us on the track and then indoors. And there was a real buzz starting to generate from that. And these you know, kids were really starting to get their kind of, you know, bearings at Cardiff Met, and they had some face-to-face lectures. And then, you know, we were also talking about some comps, and then the rug got pulled. But I have, again, been really kind of bowled over by, again, the resolve of a lot of them talking to them. And, you know, again, that they could be a lot more bitter about the whole year that's happened. But I think they're just very philosophical about the whole thing. It's really blown me away. There are some conversations with certain people that they're not 100% sure if they're going to go to university next year. But again, a lot of people are, because they kind of see that, well, it's not gone away yet. You know, what are you going to do? Put your life on hold for 1 year, 2 years? I just hope those first years that it hasn't been the first year experience, or the second years that it hasn't been the second year experience, that those that are coming back, that we really give them a proper university experience when they come back. Just because, you know, we know how much fun it is, and we know that, you know, it's something that they deserve, you know, especially those that are coming as freshers that had the rotten year last year where their A levels got cancelled. And then they got blamed for the pandemic during the summer. What should have been their best ever summer, where you're going to festivals, you're going to events, you're having laughs with your mates, you're on pretty lockdowns and going on family walks. And then they come to university and they're not allowed a freshers week. Then they're not allowed out. They're getting blamed for the spread again. And then, you know, then they're back training and then it gets taken away. So, I mean, those first years at uni, they have been absolute troopers. So yeah, I think, yeah, we'll give them a special second year when they come back next year.
Yeah, let's hope it's all good.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
You've got anything else to add, Lam? I think
I just wanted to ask a couple of fun questions, I guess. It's actually just popped into my head. Would you mind share, what do you think the greatest indoor DMR squad of any team to the athlete of all time? You can put yourself on the mark.
Oh, that's a really good question. Oh, so team to the athletes DMR. Who's going to run the 1200? I think I might have a spin. I don't know whether I'd have a spin of it. Do you put me on the spot here, Lumster? That's
it's just popped into my head as well. I was like, it's a good one.
I'm gonna upset someone here. So I think I'm going. Who's going to run the 400? That's going to be the issue, isn't it? So that's going to be an interesting one of who's the fastest person to run 400. Well, I've pretty much got it. Okay, so the 1200, I think that would probably have to be that man, Tom Marshall, I think.
Yeah.
So I'll give him the 1200. Is it the 400 next, or is it 800?
I think it goes 12, 4, 8.
12-4. Yeah. Yeah. So Paul Bradshaw trained with us for a little while, and he had some wheels. I saw him run some 48s in training. So I give the baton to Paul to roll us a nice 400. And then we're coming on to an 800. So I think that, I think in terms of speed demons that have come through the group, in terms of wheels, I think I'll give that to Jake Hayward. If he'd have rolled it in that under 20 year, I've seen him stroll 10-8 100 meter strides. And in terms of absolute, you know, what he was capable of in that under 20 year, where he ran 3:36, 7:55, we didn't get a proper. He beat Martin Longsdale up in Manchester as part of prep for the World Juniors that year. But I think he would have run 1:46 on a good day as a junior. So, he'll roll that 800. And then you've got the tough decision of either myself, Steve Mitchell, or Kieran Wood on the anchor. Obviously, you know, Mitch on his day over a mile indoors, he was tough. But I think that I'm going to give it to Dave Bishop. Reason being, he split a 3:54 DMR for New Mexico. Wow. And he also ran 3:37 and 7:56. So he's quicker than me over the mile as well. So it's got to be my first team triathlete. That obviously he came. So he came back to me after he did his finish graduating. Dave came back and he ended up qualifying for the Commonwealth Games in 2014. So running that year, ran 3:37 and a 3:56 mile. So for someone that the first athlete that I coached, I think giving him the baton. So that means I don't get a run. I'm a 3:37:15 runner. Mitch at 3:38 doesn't get a run. And Woody was in sub 3:40 shape 2 years ago anyway. So we're the three reserves on that reserve. And Jan Thomas, sub 4 minute miler, doesn't even get a look in.
Jan will love that.
Some barriers he's on the track.
Absolutely gutted. You can run a 3:59 mile and you only get a little footnote in the proceedings. So and there's probably a load of people I've forgotten as well. So apologies to anyone that I've forgotten in that. So my mind's a bit toast these days.
That's interesting. And what a squad. I'd probably go on similar, to be fair, when I was like thinking you through when you were saying it. But
trying to think if I've forgotten anyone now. That's always the thing. It's like
the mile's a weird distance, man. Like I feel like you can be really good at 15 and not quite translate to the mile.
And it's a little bit getting the races, isn't it, sometimes? Americans.
Anyway, thanks very much for coming on, James. Really, really appreciate it. And I hope you enjoyed it.
Brilliant. Love the podcast so far. You've had some fantastic guests and good to be one of them. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, guys. As always, if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service. And at the same time, if anyone's got any inquiries or feedback about the podcast, we'd really love to hear from you. So just give us a tweet at Sunday Podcast on Twitter or send us a DM. And at the same time, you can also email us. That's info@sundaypodcast.com.
Yeah, hope you enjoyed the podcast, guys. I've got a cracking episode for you next week. We're doing a bonus episode on the Wednesday with Tom Bedford. We discussed the marathon trials coming up on the Friday, the 26th of March. They also look out for those. They're being streamed live through British Athletics and on the BBC Sport website. Race walks start from 6, races then the marathon men's and women's race starts at 8 a.m. We just discussed a whole host of topics with Tom surrounding that trials race. Discussed the really good fields and the talent we got, you know, who could possibly gain selection for Tokyo. But we also discussed the challenges of putting on this event with little funding and during COVID times and how he's come about, you know, the course as well. So loads of talking points. I hope you enjoyed the podcast today and we'll see you next week. Take care.